This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. This is the final day of our Animal Week. An extraordinary German shepherd named Pasha once came to our studio. This dog has sniffed out earthquake victims who were buried under rubble and found people who were lost in the woods. Pasha was trained by an extraordinary woman named Carolyn Hebert. She co-founded the U.S. Disaster Response Team Canine Unit, whose volunteers respond to catastrophes in foreign countries. She's also co-led Northeast Search and Rescue, a group of handlers and dogs ready to search for missing persons or disaster victims anywhere in the U.S. I spoke with Hebert in 1996, after the publication of her book, So That Others May Live, a memoir about her dogs, their search and rescue work, and how that's complicated the other half of her life as the mother of four. During the interview, Hebert's dog Pasha sat quietly at her side. I asked Hebert what her search and rescue dogs are trained to do.
The main factor to understand is they're trained on human scent, not bombs, not narcotics, or anything like that. They're trained to find people who are lost. Could be an Alzheimer's patient, could be a lost hunter, lost child. They're trained to find people who have become buried or injured in things like hurricanes, tornadoes, explosions, earthquakes. They're also trained to find people submerged underwater, a drowning victim, and also to locate victims of homicide.
Now, how does your dog know what his mission is? What's expected of him?
I use different commands to a certain extent, but I also use clues. In other words, when the dog is working a disaster, first of all, he can see what's in front of him. Secondly, I don't put a vest or a collar or a leash on him. He's working completely free so he doesn't get injured. If he goes in a boat for a drowning victim, he actually wears an orange life vest. And he can see the water. He knows what's coming. For a homicide search, for instance, I will give a slightly different command to him. And also, before I go into the field, pre-scent him on a material called pseudocorpse, which is made by Sigma, which simulates the odor of a deceased person. So he knows what he's getting into.
Now, you brought your dog Pasha with you, and gosh, he's well-behaved. He's sitting right behind you now, kind of actually lying down, very quiet, very, very professional.
Well, these dogs go through a lot of obedience training, a lot of socialization, and we get them very much used to different environments. First of all, also these dogs fly in cabin on commercial and non-commercial planes, so they have to be well behaved, and they have to be able to go quite calmly through the chaos of a busy airport.
Now, you train your dogs to recover live victims.
That is their primary purpose.
How do you train a dog to recover a live victim?
It's motivational training. When you first start training a dog, it's the handler, the owner of the dog, who runs off and hides. Somebody else holds the dog. They release the dog, then you play with the dog when he finds you. You gradually increase the distance and the time and add in total strangers who go and hide for the dog. But each time the dog finds, he is rewarded with enormous enthusiasm.
And, yeah, you make it sound like it's a big game for the dog when he's being trained, like he's playing hide-and-seek.
Yes.
And when he finds the person, he gets to play, he gets some food as a reward, and it's a lot of fun.
Exactly. You want the dog to have enormous enthusiasm for a live person, because when you get to, let's say, an earthquake situation where you have both live and dead people, you want the dog to give priority to the live people before he indicates where the dead people are.
Now, in an earthquake, when he actually finds the living victim, the survivor isn't going to give him a little food reward and play with him. So does the dog ever get disappointed and think, I'm not going to play this game anymore. It's just no fun anymore.
No, because one of the things that in training, gradually the victim, we actually have what we call a non-responsive victim, the person who sits there and is obviously alive but doesn't really react very much. And it's up to the handler then who plays with the dog. So in an earthquake situation, after the dog is found, we, if it's an unstable sort of area that we're in, we wait until we go outside, and then I play with him. But he knows from my voice tone that I am happy.
And you give him food?
No. I don't train with food. Reason being that in a disaster, you have enormous amount of food that's lying around. And you want the dog to ignore that. As a matter of fact, in training, what we do in the rubble pile that we train on, I will hide hamburgers and Kentucky Fried Chicken and things like that, so that in training you can correct the dog from showing interest in that and refocus him on his real purpose.
That's interesting. Yeah, you don't want him searching out the chicken wing instead of the survivor.
Right.
Now, you've done earthquakes in Mexico, Armenia, El Salvador. What can a dog do in an earthquake situation that humans on a rescue team can't?
Well, for one thing, their noses and their sense of hearing are much keener than ours. Yes, we can smell very obvious odors, but a dog's nose is about 500 times stronger than a human nose. And they can also differentiate between live scent and dead scent, even if it's five stories down under crushed cement.
Say a victim is five stories down on a crushed cement, there's a limit to how far the dog can go. Although the dog can probably crawl through places that you couldn't. How far do you let the dog go in an unstable situation like a collapsed building in an earthquake?
Well, before we commit, we do assess the building structurally as much as we can.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we usually have someone who's got structural engineering expertise who actually goes with us. You have to think of scent moving in a building like smoke. If I were to release a smoke bomb, the smoke will go through all the little cracks and try and get out to where it can. Now, let's say somebody is five stories down in a pancaked type of building. The dog will indicate, and then we get the rescue workers to, let's say, move as safely as they can, more and more of the debris. Then we bring the same dog or another dog back in, and so that they can pinpoint a little closer as to the location.
Now, how much you believe that a trainer should always follow the dog, go where the dog goes?
I need to watch my dog.
So you'll never let your dog crawl any further than you can get yourself?
No. A dog can crawl in. Like in Kobe, he went way in. But what I did was I belly crawled to a point where with my headlamp, I could watch him.
Mm-hmm.
And because also, in a high noise situation, these dogs depend very much on hand signals or whistle blasts
right.
from us.
Now, in an earthquake, there's going to be a lot of dead people as well as survivors who are interred in the rubble, and you want your dog to find the survivors first. And yet, sometimes the dog is going to find dead. Sometimes there aren't any survivors. All the bodies are dead. What's it like for the dog when the dog finds corpses?
Every dog has a different reaction to finding a dead person. It's up to the handler to learn how to read the dog. The moment a person dies, there are definite chemical changes that take place, which the dog can detect, but we can't. Some dogs cringe. Some dogs, the hair on their backs will go up. Ollie, my old dog, his ears would go down, his tail would tuck, he'd have extreme aversion. Pasha sometimes will go and lift a leg 3 feet away from where he found. He'll sniff, he'll whine, and then he's trained to come turn around and bark at me. The reason for this was that too many people had trained their dogs on cadaver, and if you were doing a search for law enforcement and the dog started digging and destroying evidence, you were not a very popular handler.
Right, of course, of course. In your book, you write about, you know, how your dogs get, well, depressed if they find a lot of bodies, dead bodies.
Yes, they do. And even the handlers that I saw in Oklahoma finally realized that, too. And what you have to do at least once a day is to have somebody you're working with or a rescue worker who's willing to do it go hide and give the dogs a live find and just bring them back up. Also, if you have been on a search, a wilderness search, let's say, and the dog has been working all day, and the person was not in any of the areas that you covered, the worst thing you can do is to open the back of your truck, shove the dog in his crate, and that's it. What you have to do, I don't care how tired, how cold you are, the first thing you do before that dog is put in his crate is he's given more water and given a live find.
Now, getting back to the depression that the dogs have when they find a lot of dead bodies, is that because, well, you know, they haven't won the game and they haven't gotten the positive rewards, or is it something about the smell of death that really gets to the dogs?
I think it's the smell of death. I mean, I think they instinctively know that this is someone dead. I think one of the Swiss handlers in Mexico City put it very well, because I was worried about the way the four dogs that we were working with started to sort of show an aversion to even getting up and going out in the field. And the man looked at me and he said, look, this is man's best friend, and he's going to get sad if he's finding so many dead best friends. And right. I thought that was very nicely put.
My guest is Carolyn Hebert. She trains and handles search and rescue dogs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carolyn Hebert. She trains and handles search and rescue dogs.
Your dogs are German Shepherds.
Right. Just through personal preference. I have lots of other handlers that I have seen and know, not only in the U.S. but overseas, that have all kinds of different breeds. Goldens, Labradors, Border Collies, Airedales, Schnauzers, and then a wonderful breed that we call the Hardly Can.
Oh, what's that?
It's the Hardly Can Tell. You can hardly tell what it is.
The mutt?
It's the mutt, and they make superb search dogs.
That's nice to know. Now, why do you choose German Shepherds? And you literally get them from Germany.
Yes, I do. Ever since I was a child, I wanted a German Shepherd. I think my parents, in their travels, occasionally had friends who had German Shepherds. And there was something very regal, very faithful, and yet very warm about the dog.
They're kind of the officialdom of the dog world because, you know, it's shepherds that are used as seeing eye dogs and police dogs and, you know, they're the authority figures of the dog world.
Well,
watchdogs often.
Yeah, nowadays, though, people are using a lot of Rottweilers as watchdogs.
Mm-hmm.
The seeing eye in Morristown is using more Golden Retrievers and Labradors than they are German Shepherds.
Because really?
The Shepherds tend to be fairly big dogs.
Huh.
And a lot of police departments are using Labradors and different breeds for their drugs and bomb dogs.
Tell us the story of a time when one of your dogs was in grave danger because of his assignment or because of the, you know, circumstances that the dog was in.
Well, there was one scene where he was nearly shot. This was Ollie. We were actually up at a park trying to find a very poor district that had succumbed to mudslides. And I had to go behind a bush, and I took the dog with me, and all of a sudden he takes off. And I'm running behind him because the way he took off set off warning bells. And as I round the corner, there are some Salvadorian soldiers with their guns pointing straight at him. And so I'm yelling, "Don't shoot, this is a rescue dog." And I'm yelling in Spanish so they would understand. And then I have been in a lot of aftershocks with my dogs. And that, of course, is dangerous to both the human and the animal. But I know I do mention animals will sense an aftershock way before we do.
Really?
And if you can get out in time, because the dog doesn't want to stay underneath a building when he knows one is coming, the dog will give you plenty of warning.
Has that happened to you, where your dog knew before you did?
It did in Mexico. Two of us were with our dogs heading down into an underground garage, and all of a sudden the dogs just started acting strangely. And Linda, the other handler, and I looked at each other, and we said, "Look at these dogs," and we said, "Let's get out." And sure enough, as soon as we got out into the road, things started dropping.
Did that building collapse?
Where we'd been standing, things were coming down fairly rapidly. And we were trapped once in El Salvador. Couldn't get out in time. And the exit collapsed. It was in a basement. And basically, the dog found a way out, came back, and got those of us who were down there out to another end of the building.
Wow. This is like the best episode in the world of Lassie or something. You know, it's just,
well,
everybody grew up with this fantasy of having a dog that was so smart and so well-trained and so faithful, and that they'd be rescuing people and rescuing you, and that's your dogs.
They're dogs, but when they're home, they can be very normal dogs. They'll chase squirrels. They'll race around the yard.
So your dog is sometimes just a great pet at home?
Oh, when he's not working, absolutely.
I love this idea of the really professional dog who knows when he's on the job and knows when it's, you know, time to play.
Oh, no. I mean, he sleeps at night in the kitchen, and the family has learned not to leave their shoes on the kitchen floor because he will scatter shoes. He plays with them, uh-huh. And they'll be all over the kitchen.
In a way, you've lived a double life, mother of four, and then off around the world on these search and rescue missions, you know, with your dogs in earthquakes and remote hiking trails and all kinds of accidents. And you say that sometimes when you'd go home, you know, the kids wouldn't really be that interested in what happened at the earthquake in Mexico. It was like, I haven't had anybody drive me to my soccer team. I've missed practice. Now get in the car and drive me. And it must have been very disorienting for you. They're two very demanding but very different worlds.
Well, disorienting, I don't think so. I think I came very early on to the realization that basically, I had disrupted my children's lives. You know, their normalcy, their routine, mm-hmm. had been disrupted because of what they considered at that point my hobby. Also, I really, it wasn't until recently when the kids were older that I ever really showed them like slides or pictures or anything of the types of things I went to or even talked about it.
You didn't want them to know the danger you were in.
Right, and it was after they read my book, I remember my oldest daughter calling me up and saying, "Gee, Mom, we never knew this." And I said, "Well, would you have wanted to know it at 14? And she said, "I guess not."
Didn't part of you want them to know so that they could understand and appreciate what you'd done?
It would have been very hard for them, I think, to understand. Certainly they see enough on television. I mean, they would watch television and see scenes from the earthquake. But somehow what you see on television doesn't come as close as if someone who's been there sits down and says, "Well, I was in this aftershock and things collapsed around me."
Right.
And I don't want them worrying. I had an unsaid rule that when I go on any kind of mission, be it in this country or overseas, I do not call home. If I do call home, something is really wrong.
Why is that your rule?
Otherwise, they would worry if they didn't get a phone call every day.
Oh, of course. Of course.
I don't want their lives ruled by the expectation of that phone call.
Well, here's another thing. I bet you'd find it very hard to cover up the anguish that you were feeling, and you might be in the position of lying to them, saying, yeah, everything's great, when literally things are crumbling all around you.
Right. I talked to them for a certain, to a certain extent on what had happened. I'd give them a little bit of description. But most of what I would describe to them would be in terms of anecdotes, mm-hmm. the lighter moments.
Right, right.
Carolyn Hebbard, recorded in 1996. Hebbard has since moved to Florida, where she continues to teach and start rescue groups around the South. Her dog Pasha is still alive and well, but has retired. Hebbard is working with a new dog named Pedro. Both she and Pedro worked on rescues around Florida during the tornadoes in February and helped disaster efforts in Nova Scotia after the Swiss Air crash. This past Thanksgiving, Hebbard and Pedro also traveled to Argentina to conduct rescue seminars. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.